I'm excited that finally I'm getting around to the subject of South Africa, which is where I lived for a couple of years and what I talk about most. It seemed the first presentation on Monday this week we talked about Southern Africa. Didn't really deal with the country of South Africa. And last night we didn't talk about South Africa at all, but finally tonight we're getting around to it. By way of beginning, I want to say that something I've been meaning to say for the other presentations as well, and that is that I have a lot of materials with me at Holden this week, and the presentations I make are a synthesis of some of that material. If any of you are interested in the subject that we deal with and want more information, there's plenty more available, and I hope you'll feel free to come and ask me about it. On the subject of women under apartheid, I have two pages, tiny print, worth of bibliography and magazines that deal with the subject area and a lot of other stuff. So if any of you are interested in where you can get more information on this subject, I suggest you take a look at this bibliography afterwards. There's also a book here called For Their Triumphs and Their Tears by Hilda Bernstein, which is a study of women under apartheid in South Africa. And pretty much everything I say tonight, plus a lot more information, can be found in this little booklet, which is available for about $2. And finally, I have a few copies of this pamphlet called Women Under Apartheid, which I'll sell for 25 cents, if any of you are interested. I would suggest that those of you within the village, on the staff, or who will be here over an extended period of time, if you're interested, I suggest you take the address, and maybe the village could make one collective order for itself, and that way people who are only here for a day or two, or a week, or whatever, and would like to take one of these pamphlets home, then the five copies I have available would you could use. So much for resources. I wanted to make, this is a new presentation, so bear with me if it gets a little rocky at times. It's not one that I've made before. I wanted to do it for a couple of reasons. One, I know that some of you have some of you are more or less familiar with apartheid and are here out of interest in learning about how apartheid affects women in particular. And I wanted a subject area that would be of interest both to people that are familiar with apartheid and also which would serve as an introduction to apartheid for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And I hope that we'll be able to meet both needs and interests here tonight. Apartheid, how many people, as a way of getting a sense for who is coming down in which camp, can you tell me, how many people feel like they have some understanding of what apartheid is? Maybe a third of you? Fourth or a third? And the others, it's a new concept. So particularly at the beginning, I want to take a couple of minutes and lay out some background information that I hope we'll very quickly get through and we can get into the subject area of how apartheid affects women. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word. In South Africa, according to the government, there are three racial groups. The government of South Africa says we have whites, we have coloreds, and we have blacks. Whites are about 4.5 million people in South Africa, and they comprise two distinct cultures. There are two distinct white cultures in South Africa. One is an English-speaking white culture. The other has been there longer, is more of an indigenous group, and call themselves Afrikaners, who speak the Afrikaans language. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word. It comes from the Afrikaans language, and it means apartness, or separateness. The Afrikaners are the ruling white group. These two groups of whites, English and Afrikaans, have been battling back and forth for the last 180 years now. And in 1948, the Afrikaners, or about 60% of the whites, came to power. And shortly after they came to power, they inaugurated the political doctrine, political and theological doctrine, of apartheid, which is a whole network of laws that try and keep races apart in South Africa. And we'll be looking at some of those laws tonight and how they affect women. The film later on this evening focuses exclusively on the subject of Afrikaners, those whites who have been in Southern Africa for 300 years and who are the ruling group among whites. All whites have the vote. All privileges in South Africa are reserved for whites. But among the whites, there is a particular tribe that has more power than the other one. Coloreds are a mixed race group of people. That's a simplification. But I don't want to take time into tracing their ancestry right now. So suffice it to say that they are a middle group, mixed race, about 2.5 million in numbers. So the coloreds are a minority when compared with the whites. Blacks, I don't think anyone really knows how many black people live in South Africa. The estimate that I use is 20 million. I think that's safe, acceptable, I heard a black South African recently say. So blacks are far and away the majority of the people in the country. Now the South African government divides blacks up according to ethnic group or language. It says that Zulus are one group of blacks, Xhosas are another, Tswanas are another, so forth and so on. I don't like those categories. I don't think that they make sense in the long run. So the categories that I use to differentiate among the black people are threefold. One, I think it makes sense to talk about blacks who are farm laborers living on white-owned farm land. Most of the land in South Africa is owned by whites and is farmed. South Africa is an agriculturally exporting country. It has a very sophisticated farming system. And about a third, or something less than a third, of all the blacks in the country live on those white farms and work as laborers.
You have a question about
that.
I was just wondering, does that 20 million include the blacks in the homelands?
Yeah.
Okay.
So about something less than a third. I encourage those questions, and if I don't see a hand, someone who does remind me. Thanks. Something less than a third of all the blacks live on the farm, on the white-owned farms. Now they are distinct from other groups in the country. One, because they live in families, and as we're going to see tonight, most of the black people in South Africa, because of the various laws, are not allowed to live together in family units. Two, the farm laborers also are different from other groups in the sense that they are kind of cut off from their traditions. They are rural people, but do not have contact with their African traditions, at least not as much as blacks who are living in the reservations. I call them reserve peasants. Take a look at a map of South Africa. There are about 13% of the land is carved out to form reservations. And the blacks who live on those reservations comprise about a third. And these reservations are areas where whites have never really settled. And so it's a concentrated black population. And as a result, the people in those areas maintain a sense of their traditions. If they want to practice a traditional ritual, there's nothing to stop them. More or less, there's nothing to stop them. However, if blacks who are living on the white-owned farms want to practice a traditional ritual, they would have to get permission from the white farmer on whose land they live. And as a result, the traditions are not allowed to be perpetuated on the white-owned farmlands, and farm laborers are not in touch with their traditions in the same way that blacks living in the reservations are. And thirdly, third group, I call cosmopolitan. These are the blacks who live in the cities, most of them, and also a few blacks who live in the reservations but have education. I used to call this third group urban until black South Africans convinced me that you really need to include in that urban group also the well-educated blacks from the rural areas. The urban blacks, cosmopolitan blacks, are the ones who would know a lot about Europe and the United States, where it is, what black music and black fashion in the United States is like. They would tend to be better educated than blacks in these other two groups. They would know what the superpowers of the world are. They would know about the history of Africa as having been colonized by European powers who over the last couple of decades have gradually relinquished political authority. Cosmopolitan blacks, in Western terms, would be the most sophisticated group. In traditional African terms, these peasants from the reservations would be sophisticated, in terms of having contact with African tradition. Okay, that's enough enough background on who the people of South Africa are that we're talking about. Now, as I said, whites among whites, the English and the Afrikaners have been battling it out as long as they've both been living in South Africa. Afrikaners started living there in 1650. English-speaking whites started coming in 1800, and ever since 1800, they've been battling with each other. They hate each other. And in 1948, the Afrikaners came to power. The political party of the Afrikaner people won a majority of seats in the parliament in the elections of 1948. And ever since that time, they have been attempting to carry out their policy of apartheid, or separateness, because they believe that it's necessary to write into the Constitution a separation of the races. In this country, we've had a kind of racial discrimination which we call de facto, meaning that the way things work out, sometimes we have racial discrimination. In South Africa, the discrimination is de jure, or by law. It's written into the Constitution. And a lot of this constitutional framework has come to be since 1948, when the Afrikaners took power. Now, chief among the apartheid legislation, that's South Africa. Actually, it doesn't look much like South Africa, but it will do. A country about three times the size of California, which is highly industrialized today, more industrially advanced than the United States in certain fields of technology. Now, if you look at South Africa, there are certain parts of the country which we can indicate as kind of shaded regions here that are reservations, have been set aside by the government as reserves for the black people. And the government has said that they call this their Bantustan policy, also known as homelands. That's what the question up here had been about a minute ago. Bantustans, or homelands, or reservations. They all mean the same thing. And the idea of the government is that all black people should belong to one of the reservations. Whether they live there or not, they should have citizenship in one of the reservations. And the idea of the government is that ultimately they will be giving independence to each of these reservations, so that eventually South Africa can say to the world, we no longer have any black citizens. All the black people in this part of the world have citizenship in one of the homelands, or one of the Bantustans. And they have the right to vote in the Bantustan. Now that's important for understanding the situation of women in South Africa today. Because the whole economy of these shaded regions is based on migratory labor. These shaded regions, rural reservations, have no industrialized infrastructure. Almost nothing in the way of communication systems, very little in the way of transportation systems, railroads or highways or anything like that. With the result that all of the industrial areas of South Africa are in the 87% of the country which is reserved for whites. The major urban areas, Johannesburg, the gold mines up here, or Cape Town, or Durban, which is a big port, that's where the jobs are for blacks. But the black people, theoretically, according to the government, are supposed to all live in these reservation areas. Now, in fact, only about a third of them do. But the theory of the whites is that all blacks should be in these reservations unless they are working for us as whites. And the idea of the government is that through the PATH laws, don't worry if it seems like you get too much information dumped on you tonight and you can't sort it all out and you want to go to the film at 9 o'clock, it'll be between the two of them, I think you'll be able to get it straight. The PATH laws are legislation set up by the government which demands that any African who wants to leave the reservation and come to the city to work must have a pass. And the police can stop a black person in the 87% of South Africa which is set aside for whites. Police can stop a black person at any time of any day, or they can come into their home in the middle of the night and demand to see their pass. And the pass is a document which must be signed by an employer every other week, stating that this particular African has the right to live in a white area because they have a pass, because they have a job there. And what the government does is go into these rural reservation areas, which are vastly overcrowded, partly because they've been overcrowded for a long time, and also because over the last 15 to 20 years, the government has been taking a lot of blacks who live in white South Africa and forcibly removing them to the reservations, causing increased overcrowding. And now there are no jobs in these reservation areas. In this particular area here called Transkei, where I lived my first year in South Africa, 2/3 of all the workers have to leave Transkei and work here in South Africa. In other words, only 1/3 of the Transkei workforce can find jobs in the Transkei. The other 2/3 have to take jobs as migrant laborers in the cities. Now, when they go down to Mthatha, is the capital town of Transkei, when they go into Mthatha, there's a little place in town which is a recruiting office. And the mines and the factories in South Africa cooperate and have a recruiting office. And a black person who goes into the recruiting office and signs up for work is given a pass which allows him to go to Johannesburg or to Cape Town without his family. His family is not given a pass because the government believes, and this is a quote from one of the cabinet ministers in South Africa, that this African labor force must not be burdened with superfluous appendages such as wives, children, and dependents who could not provide service. In other words, the stated policy of the government is that the only people who should be leaving these reservations are men who are people who are going to work for us. And their families are just an extra burden. So the family must remain behind in the reservation. Now, if you recall what I said about the lack of jobs in the reservations, what in fact happens is that a man who is married and has a family has no choice but to live apart from his family all but 2 weeks of the year during the majority of his working age years. Now you can imagine that, and this is how the economy is based, and this is one of the reasons why the 350 American corporations that do business in South Africa make record profits, because they don't have to concern themselves with all of the expense involved with caring for an entire family, all the families of their workers, or building housing to take care of the families of their workers. All they have to do is build a big dormitory for their workers, all men, and they bring the workers from the reservation, house them in the dormitory, and feed them, and give them their pay. And this results in it's one of the things which results in cheap labor for the foreign companies that do business there. Now, you can imagine that when a man leaves his family for all but 2 weeks of the year, the consequences for family life are disastrous. And women bear the brunt of this. Because it's women who remain behind in the reservation area with the children, an area which is vastly overcrowded. And when the man first goes off to the city or to the mines to work, people have done studies, and statistically you can chart that initially the man will be sending home a pretty healthy portion of his paycheck every month to his wife and children. But the longer a man stays in the urban area, the less the amount of money that comes back to feed the family. And the longer the man stays in the area, the better the chance he will eventually take on another family in the city where he's living. Because if a man is living in the city for 50 weeks of the year, sees his family only 2 weeks of the year, it's usually only a matter of time before he takes on another family. And once he has two families to support, less and less money goes back to the reservation. Because over time, a man is forced to choose between supporting the family that he lives with most of the time and the family that he never sees. And in the end, it's usually the family he lives with that wins out in terms of his loyalty. So the effects on family life are disastrous of this migratory labor system. And it's very common that after a woman's husband has been away working in the mines or in the cities for a long enough period of time and she virtually loses contact with him, that what she has to do is place her children in the care of a grandmother or an aunt, and then she goes off to the cities to try and find work herself, with the result that a lot of children in South Africa are raised without direct contact with either one of their parents.
How many men are employed in this fashion in South Africa?
From the reservation areas, it would be a vast majority. I mean, did you want numbers?
Well, you said like there are 20 million blacks in total.
Yeah.
Are you talking about 1 million blacks coming in from the reservations into the cities under these circumstances?
Yeah. Roughly 1 million. 20 million, let's see, that'd be about 6 or 7 million who live in the reservations, and of those, yeah, I think 1 million is probably a conservative guess. Yeah.
What government or organization controls South Africa? Is it the same as West Africa?
No.
Well, West Africa, I was amazed when I heard this, because West Africa is so much different, because I have worked there for Standard Oil Company, and this is quite interesting to me, and I'm just wondering who controls that area.
Yeah, South Africa is entirely different from any other African country. You ought not make any parallels. In West Africa, whites couldn't live until about 1850, when a cure for malaria was discovered. In South Africa, whites have been living as long as they've been living here in North America, since about 1650. And whites are 20% of the population in South Africa. In West Africa, they would be 2% of the population. And South Africa has its own government, has a very long, complicated history that I don't want to go into right now, because in traditional African society, people didn't own the land. The land was owned by the chief who administered it on behalf of his people. And the people under a given chief were given the right to use a piece of land for a period, you know. You would go to the chief, and the chief would give you a parcel of land. And at a later point, if you could make a case to the chief that you needed a bigger section, you might get it. If the tribe grew too much, maybe the chief would take a little bit of that land away from you eventually and spread it out according to the needs of the rest of the community. Now, in South Africa, women only get land if they are married. Men tend to get the land in the first place. Now, if a woman is married to a man and the man dies, the woman becomes a widow, and she has children, she can keep the land as long as she continues to live on it. But she must maintain a continuous residence in order to continue rights to that property. As soon as she leaves the land, for example, if a woman leaves the land and goes off to the cities to take work because there's no work available where she's living and she's got to have some way of supporting her children, she loses the right to that land. And virtually the only way a woman can get land without having been living on that piece of land when her husband died is if she's a widow and she has children. Then she stands some chance of getting a piece of land. Otherwise, she must link up with some kind of a male figure who has more access or more right. Well, that's as long as we're talking about living on the land, land ownership, that kind of thing, let's cover housing in the urban areas. Now, there are a number, about a third of all the blacks live in the urban areas today. Theoretically, they shouldn't be there unless they have a job, in which case they have a pass, and then they should only be there during their working age years. And as soon as their working age years are up, then the idea of the government is they should go back to the reservations. In other words, according to the theory of the government, they would prefer that a black person never come to the city until they're of working age, and then they come in and they spend their working age years in the city, and as soon as they reach a retirement age or they lose their jobs and they can't find another one, then they should be shipped back to the reservations. Now, that in theory is what the government would like to think happens, except for those blacks who live and work on white-owned farmland. And I've already indicated that about a third of the blacks are born on a white farm, and they live their whole life on that farm, and they die on that farm. And you have many farms in South Africa where the same white family has been living on the same farm for several generations and has been serviced by the same black families. So that for generation after generation, much as you had in the plantation south in this country. You got the same black family working for the same white family over and over and over and over.
Is there a determined retirement age for those
people? Not necessarily. It would be according to how effective you were and what kind of work you were doing and how long
they can't
you could
just
hold
kick
up.
Them out.
Yeah.
There is
I mean, at a certain point, they would just be told, look, you're not any use to us.
And there's anymore. No retirement system, no help after they leave work.
Well, there is a certain Social Security pension kind of system. It's very minimal, and the number of people that qualify is small, but I wouldn't want to say that there is no such system, because then I'd be open to just the kind of thing that white South Africans are always looking for, because there's a lot of exaggeration about South Africa, and white South Africans, because they can find a little exaggeration here and there, tend to throw out all foreign criticism. So I try and bend over backwards in terms of not exaggerating, although inevitably I do at certain points just for purposes of generalization. But I try and avoid it because I think a lot of what could be constructive criticism from the West, in fact, is being thrown out by white South Africans because some of it is based on exaggerated information. So there is a small pension system, and certain companies would offer it, but there's also a certain social security system through the government, available within certain type of work. Women in South Africa, we want to talk about employment, 91% of the entire female workforce is engaged in one of two occupations, either that of domestic service, maids, gardeners, nannies, that kind of thing, or farm laborers. Those are the two categories in which 91% of the female workforce is employed. Those are also the two categories which have no minimum wage requirements according to government legislation, no unemployment benefits, and no other forms of Social Security. So in terms of the type of work which women are engaged in, these receive the least of an already small amount of benefits that derive from government policy.
The professional?
Yeah, the two key middle class jobs available to women are teachers and nursing. Those are two solid middle class jobs, and if an African can get education and pursues it in one of those two fields, they can get a job as a teacher or a nurse, and in both fields they would probably be entitled to some kind of a pension after they had worked long enough, and probably some kind of unemployment benefits, although in both cases the amount would be small, but there would be something.
By what effort do they get this education?
By their own effort. Education in South Africa is divided. Apartheid, the policies of apartheid, when they came to be in 1948, the government said, we're going to since we're moving on to a new area, I'll take your question and then we'll come back to education.
Well, it was basically on the same theme. I was wondering, is there discrimination between the pay for black teachers and nurses as compared to white teachers?
Oh yeah, certainly. And also among men and women. I mean, in every field of work, black and white receive nothing like the same level of pay. In the mines, for example, where a lot of Africans work, the white miners who work side by side with black miners receive 10 times the pay for the same work. Well, not for the same work, because the jobs for whites would be different jobs. I mean, the government came in, one of the ways in which the government came to power in 1948 was by promising white miners that if the Nationalist Party came to power, the Nationalist Party would pass job reservation, which would set aside certain jobs for whites. In other words, all jobs in the country would be classified as jobs for whites or jobs for colors or jobs for blacks. And in the mines, what this amounted to was the skilled level jobs were reserved by law for whites, and unskilled jobs were reserved by law for blacks. Now they work next to each other at the bottom of the mine. They face much the same kind of working conditions, but a white will receive 10 times the pay as a black person. So there's no comparison across racial lines for pay. Now, within a given racial category, such as African, you'll find pay discrimination between men and women. For example, in the teaching profession, same kind of work, the lowest level of pay for an African male teacher is equivalent to the highest level of pay that a female teacher can get. I think it's about $1,600 a year is starting pay for an African teacher, according to the statistics that I saw, which came out of a publication that's about 2 or 3 years old. And it can go up to $1,600 to $3,400 is the pay for a male teacher, a black male teacher. For a black female teacher, the pay ranges from $1,500 to $1,600. Before, that's real good, and I want to pursue that. But before I do that, I want to finish talking about education a little bit. The government, when it came in, and when the nationalist government came to power in 1948, part of their policy was to segregate the educational sphere. Up until that point, you had churches running some educational institutions, which included some of the finest educational institutions in the country, including some universities, that were run on a multiracial basis. In particular, the best university in the country had been opened multiracially to blacks and whites, because it was run by a church organization that was committed to this kind of policy. Well, the government came to power and said, now, blacks and whites are always going to be holding different kinds of jobs. So there's really no reason to offer them the same kinds of educational training. The whites are going to need a different kind of education because they're going to be holding higher jobs. Blacks will never graduate to that level, so they ought to have a different kind of educational system. And the government in 1954 declared that all multiracial education had to stop. Today, the government spends more than 10 times as much per education of a white child as it does per black child, which is why there have been educational strikes going on. I was told at supper tonight that Newsweek, the current issue of Newsweek, has a big story on an educational boycott, which has been going on in South Africa for the last almost a month now. Because increasingly, black and colored school children are insisting that this is just grossly unfair, that the government should spend 10 times the amount per white child as it does per black child. On top of that, and this goes back to the original question of how do blacks get to be a nurse or a teacher, on top of that, white education is free and compulsory. Black education is optional and requires the payment of school fees. The poorest people in the country have to pay for their education, which is of an inferior quality to begin with. And part of the strikes on the part of colored school children right now are over issues like being forced to buy school uniforms. The government, under the British, influenced by the British system, insists that school children should wear uniforms. All school children should wear the same uniform because it looks nice. Black and colored people in South Africa who are struggling desperately to feed themselves feel that school uniforms are a luxury, an option, and they would rather not have to be paying that kind of fee, so the children are on strike. Also, they're on strike because they demand that the government should spend the same amount on all children. But the government's position is, well, if we did that, how in the world would we ever be able to provide the highly technical type education that we need to run an industrial society? And just as, in a sense, I think ultimately we in this country are going to face the same issue, because there are workers in third world countries who labor in a Ford Motor Company or any other multinational company who are paid very low wages in South America or Asia or Africa. And as a result of the low wages paid to those workers, high profits are returned to American investors, including American churches and pension funds and individuals who own stock. And those profits, which are not put into the pay packet of a third world worker, come back to us in the form of investment profit, which is the way we run our universities. Now what happens if a factory worker in South America begins to say, I want the same quality education for my child as is being made available through my work to children in the United States? Are we going to be willing to cut back in the quality of education that we offer our children? Or are we going to fight? And that's the same issue that's before white South Africans today. They cannot continue to maintain their industrial society if they offer the same education to everyone. Now, I think what blacks would be willing to settle for are superior educational opportunities being made available to people of both races, and recognize that you're going to have to spend more money on a university than you are on a primary school. Okay, now I want to go on to the very important question about how black workers... you see how a person gets to be a nurse or a teacher because their parents work very hard and pay for them to get all the way through their schooling. But that's a lot of money over a long number of years. And it means that the child has to get good grades in a classroom of 100 students with one teacher. That's very typical. In the Transcon where I was, that was a low average, 100 pupils per classroom. Now, to advance through that kind of an educational system is at best somewhat arbitrary. A black, as I said, let me get the statistics right now. The chief occupation of black women in South Africa is that of domestic service. Virtually all of you, all of us, if we were South Africans, would have domestic service available to us. At least we'd have a maid coming in one or two days a week. And a good half of us would have a full-time maid, at least one. And many of us would have more than one full-time servant, which is the kind of thing you can get used to pretty fast and you rebel against any threat that you may have to change that. These maids are paid from $25 a month on up to $60 or $70 a month. So for $25 a month, you can have a full-time maid. The maid is expected to work at least 6 days a week. She's usually given Sunday off. However, it's very common that if her master and missus are entertaining guests on a given Sunday, then it's just expected that she will spend at least part of her day off working for them, and without necessarily any compensation. Now, of course, this kind of thing varies a lot. You do have some whites who have a maid that they have who has been working for them for 25 or 30 years, who they've become, in a way, very close to, and who may choose to treat her well. And if they use her services on Sunday, maybe they'll give her another day of the week off. Although you can bet that on the day of the week that she's not there, all the dishes that she would be doing, she'll have to do the next day. They pile up. She'll start work very early in the morning, 6 o'clock or so. She'll come in, make the fires, to heat up the house, get breakfast ready, get the children off to school, get the parents, the head of the household off to, or both husband and wife, off to their respective work. She'll clean the house. Maybe she can take a break for an hour or so in the afternoon. Then she starts making dinner. She does the dinner dishes. She gets the children off to bed. And maybe about 9 or 10 at night, she can retire for the day. She'll be released by the madam or the master.
Is the South African home then fairly labor intensive as compared to ours, where they don't have dishwashers, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. You wouldn't find many vacuum cleaners or dishwashers or those kinds of implements which are of aid to people who keep house in our society, because you have domestic servants to do that. $25 would go a little bit further in South Africa than it would here on the average. For some things it goes not as far. For some, certainly for any imported goods, are more expensive there than they would be here. But food tends to be a little cheaper in South Africa than it is here. Although that's also racially oriented. See, I mean, the whole parliament, the only people who vote in South Africa, of course, are whites. And that means the only people who hold office are whites. And that means when a political issue comes up and the demands of the economy require that the government has to reduce its subsidy on certain foodstuffs, meat, which whites tend to eat more than blacks, would be favored over bread, which affects blacks more directly than it does whites. You get the point here that as a result of a white government, it's inevitable that the kinds of policies taken on particular foodstuffs tend to discriminate against blacks, because if you raise the price of the food that the blacks eat, such as mealy meal or cornmeal, which is a staple in the African diet, that's not going to hurt me as a politician who has to face re-election, because I don't have any blacks voting for me. If I raise the price of meat, which whites are eating, then, or if I take action, which in effect raises the price of meat, then my constituency is likely to be angry with me about that. In general, I found, as a white living in South Africa, that food was a little cheaper than it is in this country. But I'm not sure that that necessarily means that it's cheaper for blacks than it is for us. But in the end, it's not that big of a difference. Your dollar might go a little further in South Africa, but not that much farther.
What would be the social implications if you chose to go down there and live and brought your own dishwasher and didn't use the services of a maid? What would be the feeling of other whites toward you? I mean, what would be the social implications if something like that would take place?
Well, whether you brought your own dishwasher or not, as an outsider white, white South Africans would be extremely defensive. I mean, I hitchhiked around the country. Within 30 seconds of people's finding out that I was an American, always there would be, and what do you think of our society? And the implications of that question were always very clear. Whites in South Africa know that those Americans who come to South Africa have heard a little bit about it. Most Americans, of course, don't know anything about South Africa, like you were saying. You have no idea that this kind of thing exists down there yet. We will, within 5 years, know a lot more than we know right now. That whole issue of black response to their situation is one that I'd like to address myself to in an entire presentation later next week. I'll devote one of my whole presentations to what have blacks been doing to try and change their situation. Very briefly, I'll say that if you look at the history of the protest movement, adults have generally become passive, or had been, since 1960, when the government engaged in a very crushing response to peaceful protests. I mean, they just started slaughtering people who were engaging in peaceful protest and banned all the organizations that were committed to peaceful protest. At that point, adults, parents, started laying back and saying, well, what can we do? And it is today, particularly since 1976, youngsters from age 8 through 20, 25, who are the most active proponents for change. And I would say that in the last 2 or 3 years, increasingly, parents are beginning to say, our children over the last couple of years have taught us a lesson, that it's better to face death for standing up and speaking what we believe to be true than it is to go on living enslaved in this kind of a system. But that's a lesson that parents are only now beginning to recognize their children have taught them by children facing those guns, particularly in the uprising of 1976, when about 1,000 school children were killed in 1 year by police guns. Parents have begun to believe that perhaps it is necessary that children face those guns, and if they're going to face the guns, maybe it's better they do so holding guns than stones. So some parents have begun to accept the need for this kind of reality. Now, to get back to your question about the social reality faced by a white who would try and ignore it, if you came as an outsider white to South Africa, there'd be a lot of suspicion on the part of the whites there that you had the wrong story, that you had been exposed to a lot of exaggerated information, which is often true on the outside, and that all you have to do is get some better information, be schooled by the local white population, and increasingly you will come around and you will see that the system is not so bad as you thought before you went. Now this happens to 99% of the whites who go to South Africa, because as I said, it's very easy to get used to a system of having maids all the time and having a tremendous privilege worked in your favor. You go to a city like Johannesburg, the streets are clean, it's safe compared to any American city, you're relatively safe from the kind of crime that you face in an American urban environment, and all of those kinds of things add up to your opinion that, well, the system is pretty good. You got a maid who comes in, who tells you what you want to believe in relation to every single question you ask her, so you get the impression fairly quickly that, well, she seems pretty satisfied, and she seems happy, and anyway, you don't think too much about it. All you're appreciating is the good weather, sunny South Africa, and the beautiful geography, and all of this privilege, the luxurious lifestyle that you can live. And eventually, what happens is that because you're in a black township and you never really see how blacks are living, and you never get any honest communication with blacks, you eventually come around to join whites in their thinking. And because it has been their experience that most whites arrive at that kind of a change of heart after they've been in South Africa for a while, any white South African who recognizes that you're new to the country will aggressively lobby you. And in general, if you try and withstand that lobbying, life would not really be very pleasant. I've talked to some American Lutheran missionaries, for example, who go down to South Africa to take a white congregation, and who end up either they end up agreeing that the system is in fact is the best one possible, and that whites are doing the best job that they can, and that in general blacks are better off in South Africa than they are anywhere else in the country, anywhere else in Africa, and the government, which controls the media, is constantly pushing that kind of information in front of people every day to convince whites in South Africa that blacks in South Africa are better off than they are anywhere else in the continent. Or, in a more rare case, an American Lutheran minister will end up cutting his term of service in South Africa short because he just ultimately, I talked to one a month ago in Portland, who said, eventually I just, you know, it came down to it, a congregational meeting was called, and they asked me where I stood, and I told them that I didn't feel that apartheid was a Christian system, and so we parted ways, and I came back to the States early.
Well, I had the same thing happen to my niece and her husband. They had been missionaries there for 15 years, and the same thing happened. He said he just couldn't take that system, and they just quit and came back to the United States.
Now, of course, another thing is that you would not, were they working with whites or with blacks?
Well, they were working with the blacks.
Were they? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, that's also a common situation, that you would, in fact, go out to a rural reserve area and that you would work in a mission station in one of those reserves.
They were in Zululand.
In Zululand, right, one of the reserves over here. And in that situation, the white pressure will not be as intense because you got a different kind of white living there than you do in the cities, where whites would have nothing to do with blacks. I mean, in the cities, whites would consider the black people, South African whites in the cities would look with suspicion on whites who would choose to live in the reservation area, because they would say, you know, this isn't right. This is contrary to the created order of the way God created it. God created us differently, and we ought to be living apart. And anyone who wants to cross those boundaries, something isn't right. Unless they do so with a certain mission spirit, and on the mission station, they keep themselves separate. Education at universities in this country, fat budgets that our churches run on because of investment policies, pension funds, I mean, anybody know where the money from pension funds comes from? It comes from investments. And the rate of return on your investment in South Africa is higher than from any other country in the world. And the consequence of that is an infant mortality. One of the consequences is an infant mortality rate of 50% under the age of 5. You mothers who have children, imagine which half of your children you wouldn't have. Healthcare in the rural areas is worse than it is in the urban areas. In no place is it good, although the white South Africans are good at building. Outside of Johannesburg, for example, in the black township of Soweto, the largest hospital south of in the entire southern hemisphere. And then this is the kind of statistic which is put in front of whites to show that blacks are better off in South Africa than they are anywhere else in Africa. Now, you can build a huge hospital for blacks in South Africa, and it still doesn't necessarily mean much, except in relation to how many people are having to use it. Although I believe it is true that there are more hospitals available to blacks in South Africa per capita than there are any other country in Africa. But black South Africans have said to me the issue is not how we in this modern industrialized country compare with blacks in other non-industrialized countries. The issue is how do black South Africans compare with white South Africans. And that's the kind of statistic which is not put in the minds of in front of whites. Hospital or medical care is much better in relation to, much better for whites than it is for blacks. I forget the statistics right now, but it's something like, I forget the statistic, and rather than exaggerate, I won't quote, but the number of doctors per capita is much, much better for whites than it is for blacks. If I go back to this issue of how what life was like for a domestic servant, I gave something of the workday schedule of that woman, and the fact that she may be told you can have off a few hours in the afternoon, But if the missus happens to come home with the shopping in the middle of that time, it's just accepted that she can call Lizzie to come and help her bring the groceries in. And there's no necessarily compensation for that. Now, that domestic servant would not be allowed to, if she's a live-in maid, someone had asked a question about, are most of these live-in maids? If you can afford it, you'll have a live-in maid who, by law, is not allowed to stay in your home with you, but must stay out back in a little hut. She'll have a bedroom, which is usually adjoined to the garage, and most in white areas of South Africa, the architecture is built this way. The home, and then the garage, and off the garage, there's one small bedroom, maybe the size of something like this. Just about enough room for one bed. Now, it's illegal for any man to be staying there with her. It's illegal for her to have her children staying there with her. I had some friends who had a maid that they liked. She had been working with them for a while. And I knew them over a period of time. And once I came over to dinner, and they said, yeah, Lizzie's children. She snuck her children in now. And she had managed to keep the children hidden in this tiny room for a certain period of time. But eventually, the master and madam found out about it. And they said to her, well, you got two here. We know you got two more back in the reserves. As long as you don't bring the other two and you keep these two out of sight, it's okay. A woman is not allowed to bring her family. Now, she may have a family in Johannesburg, 15 miles away, and if she gets a day off once a week, then she can go to Johannesburg and stay with her family. The housing, getting rights to the housing is very complicated, and it's much better described in this pamphlet than I could take the time to do right now. But it would be common that, not common, but there would be many people who, say, live in Soweto. Soweto is the black township outside of Johannesburg, 15 miles away, where the blacks are supposed to live. Because even though Soweto is in the white area here, it's not part of the reservation, it's still a segregated community from Johannesburg. When the Afrikaners came to power, they took Johannesburg, which included some black ghettos, and they just bulldozed those ghettos and forcibly moved all the black people 15 miles outside of Johannesburg to this township. Now, maybe the woman lives in Johannesburg in the backyard of a white family that she works for. Maybe the husband works on the mines and lives in a hostel. And on Sunday, they come home where there's a grandmother taking care of a household of children. And on Sunday, maybe the family, if they're lucky, if they're one of the lucky ones, the family can all gather one day a week.